Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Through the Tech Vine. So be quiet, pay attention, and get inspired. There is one truth that is not told enough. Technology is not magic, but it can be magical. Technology is human. It is part of who we are, our evolution, our future. Will it be a dystopian or utopian one? Well, that is up to us and nobody else. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Maybe you need to learn how to count.
I need to count how to learn.
How? And we're over 10 episodes, so I think your guess, I'm guessing you're having problems because the fingers.
It's consistent. I've lost a number of fingers. I still have all my digits. Didn't know how to transition from fingers to toes, I guess, to count.
Well, if you wear flip-flop, you can use your feet.
I am wearing flip-flops.
You can get up to 20. All right, welcome everybody. We're back, and we are old school radio. I think we decided that we like it that way. Nobody needs to see our face. And Diana, I think there is still that crackling. Are you calling us from the dark side of the moon?
No, I don't think it was my chair, because I did move my chair again.
Mm-mm. Something on with a microphone that is like making some weird crackling noise. John, you hear that too?
I do. I just thought it was my brain crackling.
I don't know. Is it bad enough? Should I just like drop off? Because
yeah, it's just pretty bad. So try to jump off and come back on again. See what happens.
Okay.
In the meantime, we will entertain.
Do 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 do.
Sean, while we wait for Diana, anything new to tell us? Something that catch your attention? Not maybe in the technical aspect of things, but something that caught your attention so we can do some chit-chatting while we wait for Diana and we start talking about tech.
Well, this show is where I kind of break free of the security realm. And really focus on the broader tech world, which then means most of my thoughts and efforts and time is spent on security stuff. So,
you know, that's a good point. How hard it is to kind of break from what is your specialization, where you for 99% of the time you're filtering every news that you get, everything that you read, maybe even when watching TV and something, it's kind of like, I don't know, an animation movie or something fantasy. And maybe you, I don't know, do you always default on security and cybersecurity?
I think definitely, there's definitely a hue of color across everything I look at. The other thing I'll note is I've actually caught up with a few old friends, not in person, only on the phone. Or Zoom or Microsoft Teams, wherever we ended up having to connect online. But it was fun catching up with folks I haven't spoken with in a few months. And I think that a lot of people that I've spoken to are focusing on new things in their career or a new career in general. And it's exciting to see people branch out and do new things.
So you feel like some people did take the opportunity of this change with the whole pandemic, working from home, to kind of like rediscover maybe a new passion, maybe find the time to say, hey, let me look inside. And is this really what I want to do? Or maybe do I need to add something to the mix? Because I kind of feel that way.
Yeah, definitely. And I think some of it is personally driven. Some of it is company driven. Some of it's market driven. A lot of the change, right? So sometimes you can control it, sometimes you can't.
Yeah, and they say you're working from home, so you kind of rediscover the pleasure of doing things at home. Maybe if between a meeting and another, you jump on and do some gardening, or maybe get in the garage hammer on a bicycle, or you know what I mean? It's like your life is not just evenly split, or I'm saying evenly in a good way, because I don't think it's even, but more time spent in the office and rediscover what you can do at home. So I think after all, there is something that good can come out of this. I hope so.
I think so.
Let's see if something good came out of Diana coming back. Tell us something.
How do I sound?
Oh, wonderful. You remind me of your old days of DJing.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So all just right. Get a little goose. All right.
You know, when you called the tech support, did you restart the computer? Did you unplug and replug? Did you kick it?
Chris O'Dowd and the IT crowd, right? You know, have you tried turning it on and off again?
Yeah, and people get offended. It's like, I'm in cybersecurity. I know what I'm doing, but oh, I forgot to unmute my microphone. Okay, you know, stuff happened.
I know what I'm doing except when I'm not clear what I'm doing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Diana, we were just chit-chatting about, you know, things that maybe we've used the time of working from home to maybe rediscover some hobby, catching up with friends, do a little gardening, and, you know, finding the time that we can spend at home between a meeting and another to squeeze in things that we like. And maybe that is the way to go. So anything you have rediscovered as a passion working from home?
Well, you know, it's weird because I've worked from home officially for about 25 years.
There you go.
I just was on. Yeah, but I was on the road so much that I was always out of the house. Yeah, so it's been this kind of interesting mix between, now I haven't been on the road as much, but my at home time is similar, but I'm home a whole lot more than I ever was in the past. So have I rediscovered anything? I guess just mostly I've really, really enjoyed getting closer with the dogs because they're very social. And they care if you're there or you're not there. And I'm pretty sure that Nora had decided that she needed a backup me. She picked her guy at the daycare where they go to stay socialized. And I think she just decided, like, you know, he was a backup in case one of these days I left the house and never, ever came back. So it's been kind of nice that she has felt that she can depend on having me around. Although now I'm a little bit nervous about that because I'm going away on Monday for WESIS. So Nora's gonna, and I don't know how to tell her. It's okay, I'll be back.
The cat's
out of the bag, so to speak. I think she knows now.
Well, she has a backup.
She's listening to this episode.
She does have a backup. I mean, she really, this guy, she's ready. She's ready to transfer her affections permanently if it comes to that.
You know, I gotta say that it gives you the peace of mind. You know, I mean, people know, I think, that we have three dogs, used to have four, and then one went through the Rainbow Bridge not too long ago. But yeah, when we leave for weeks or even a month, and you know that they're staying in a place or they're having fun, maybe there are other dogs, and you know, you want them to be happy. I don't want them to miss me. In an unselfish way, I guess, but you know, I want them to be happy when I'm not around.
I completely agree, because my last dog, you know, because unfortunately I don't live long enough. So my last dog that I was really close to, Kenny, he had a vocalization that he only made when he saw me and he saw this one person at the old daycare and boarding place that they would go. And the first time I heard him make that vocalization for this other person, I was really hurt, because I thought, oh,
you were jealous. Come on.
Yeah, I was jealous. And then I realized exactly what you're saying, Marco, which is that, thank goodness, he loves this other person that much, so he's not miserable when I'm gone. He's having fun and being with people he cares about. But so it's really nice to see, but I also do have to keep my jealousy a little in check.
Well, you know, it's a healthy amount of jealousy, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you mean? You go and sniff this other person? You should just sniff mine. Oh, yeah. They definitely got used to have me home all the time. So that's a good thing. But I'm like you. I pretty much work from home almost all my life. And, you know, the travel, that's what we've been missing as well.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll go back to that.
Travel.
Yeah.
Well, it's
so,
both directions. I think we get used to being home with them as well.
Oh, yeah.
Marco, you know, true. I haven't shared it publicly, but a little white fluffy pet also took the bridge, Rainbow Bridge, a couple weeks ago, which is very sad. And yeah, so there's a routine, right? And that routine kind of changes for both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's giving and taking, you know, that's what relationships are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, that goes to show again, and that for people looking at now, there is pictures of me and my dog and a dog and Sean on, I don't know, are you on Mars here or an astronaut? The International Space Station? I know where you are, by the way.
You do know where I am. That's the International Space Station. I was launched up there a couple of weeks ago.
I tell you what, let's do a promotional plug for something that we're pretty passionate about it now, and then we dive into tech because it is about tech. So when I look at the picture, I remember where we were and what we're doing now with the US cyber gang. So tell us a little bit about that, Sean. I'm interviewing you right now.
That's right.
Nice.
There we go. So this, I mean, this is one of the early events that Katsai and Jessica Gulick, who leads that team there, put on. It's the, I'm trying to remember the name of that event, but it was at the HyperX gaming studio in Las Vegas. And yep. A number of teams competed, cybersecurity teams competed against each other, attacking, defending. And yeah, it was pretty cool. So that this picture is from the hallway. Actually, of that event, the runway into the on stage game room that everybody went to
the arena
from when they went into,
which is
the arena,
pretty exactly. Cool. It almost looked like you're inside a Star Trek a spaceship, or I don't know, a control command for a mission to the moon from NASA. Really, really cool. And what they're doing now. That was the 2019, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But this one here is different, and it's really cool because it's involving not just a single event and in a single country, but it's called the US Cyber Games because they're putting together a selection, put it together a team, and then they're competing against other, I believe, 7 teams from 7 different countries. Part of the world, and the finalists are going to actually go to Athens in Greece, and they're going to compete for some kind of a first, world championship of cybersecurity, cyber game defenders, and it's going to be cool, and hopefully that's going to be the first one of many, so very exciting and good way to train people to come in the cybersecurity industry. As we all know, we kind of need that. All right, so I think we've got already talking about technology, but let's move into what we're here for, and what I assume people are here to listen and hopefully discuss about with their family and friends, and you know, even online. Feel free to comment and agree or disagree to what we do talk about, what we say, because I know we're very opinionated, so it's okay.
I object.
Yeah, you can disagree. That's cool. I don't care. I know. You know. I take the disagreement as a. Yeah. I disagree with myself all the time too. So why not? All right. So Sean, we're here for tech news.
Yes, through the tech vine, where we pick stories, sometimes recent, other times maybe in the past, but refreshed in some way that catch our attention, inspire us, piss us off, hopefully with a vision for technology can be good, right? So I think most of the conversations we have are driven by that. And then, of course, as you and I were rapping about, as Diana was rejoining, there's always a hue of risk management and cybersecurity that we tend to have layering on top of all this stuff just by nature of what we do for a living most of the
time.
Know,
so I want to just say that there should always be, no matter what, a layer of cybersecurity, like a little filter on everything we do when it comes to technology, a little filter on privacy, a little filter on ethics, and yeah, being secure. That's definitely something that is not a bad thing to add to the ingredients.
Yeah, by design, build it in, because it's hard to tack privacy and security on later after the fact. So the more we can think of it up front, the better. And I think the more transparent it can be.
Yeah, absolutely. We discussed about that with you and in the book that you wrote. So
yeah.
Good time. People should catch up on that. But let's get in. Diana, what catches your attention? I see you have a name and Aqua Diana. You're like some Aqua Woman, superhero.
We're gonna talk water.
All right, figure that.
You're right. This is one of those things that it's not new, but there's a new deployment that's going on in Port San Antonio with this kind of technology, which is why it was in the news in the last couple of days. So it just sort of bubbled it up, and I thought it was it's a cool technology, and it still needs to be worked on and deployed a little bit more. But yeah, I thought it would just be kind of nice to talk about it. And it's about water. And one of the things I thought was interesting in water in general is that it can feel like with the flooding and the droughts and the melting polar ice caps, it can feel like we're running out of water, right? Or maybe it's shifting a bit in the wrong places. But interestingly, we're not. The water has been, we have about the same amount of water on the earth now that we had a million years ago. And most of that water, do you guys know where, I didn't know where that water came from until I researched for this. Do you guys know where most of the water from on the earth came from?
I know the theory of a meteorite bringing the water, but I know it's a theory.
Amazon delivered.
Comets. Yeah, Amazon. Comets. Amazon Prime.
A lot of jars of 1 gallon water. Yeah, a meteorite. So it's alien. We are alien. So
comets. Yeah. Well, comets. I mean, yeah, I can't. Well, the Earth came from, aliens.
we don't know where they got that water from anyway, right?
Where did the comets get it from? That's a good point. But yeah, our water came from comets, or as scientists call it, dirty ice balls, because there's a whole bunch of stuff in there with the water. And once it's here on Earth, because of our magnetic field, which scared me a little bit, because apparently if we lost our magnetic field, the water would kind of drift away, as I understand it, which seems very scary. But anyway, because of the magnetic field, we keep our water with us. And there's a little bit of loss up in the very high atmosphere when water gets up there, because when the ultraviolet rays from the sun are strong enough, they can split it back into hydrogen and oxygen. And hydrogen's light enough to get blown away by solar winds, but the oxygen stays on Earth. So we've got sort of a fairly static amount of water. It's just it goes into areas where it's not recoverable. It can get really deep into the earth. You can also get issues where, like, you're in a very humid area, but you can't get to that water to drink it. And so this is about what do you do in those kinds of situations. There's water all around you in the atmosphere. If you've ever been in a humid area, you know, you can feel it all around you, but how do you drink it? And this technology is about reclaiming that water so it can be distilled out of the atmosphere. They're called atmospheric water generators, and they work fairly similarly to the way that dehumidifiers work in our houses, except that instead of going into just a bucket that's kind of dirty and can be slimy after a while if you don't clean it, which can happen with home dehumidifiers, it's captured from the atmosphere, and as it's reclaimed, they distill the water. So I thought that was just really cool. As I said, there's a new deployment going on in Port San Antonio with one vendor. A number of vendors and organizations are working on AWGs, atmospheric water generators. So I just thought it was a cool tech. And one of the existing problems could be solved by some more cool tech, which is how do we power them? I'm kind of hoping that some company's gonna, or maybe some has, and I just couldn't find it in my searches, will marry renewable energies to AWGs so that the wind or solar power can also help to power these giant AWGs, which again are sort of like very giant dehumidifiers, but also distill the water in the process. So that was it. That was my cool tech.
That is cool. In fact, one of the friends I caught up this week, we were actually talking about water and scarcity of water and the future will be based on who owns the rights to water. And so the first thing that comes to my mind based on the conversation I had last night is, well, who owns the airspace that this is collecting the water from? And I mean, if it's in a path on to somewhere else and somebody's capturing, just like a river, right? If somebody comes in and dams up the river in the middle of somebody else's river rights and starts taking the water out of it.
That's a little out there
what I'm thinking, but it's.
I know, I was just thinking, oh, that's exciting because if you're in a humid area, but you have no water to drink, here's a great way to get water. But you do have a good point if it becomes, because there have been issues with who owns air rights and building rights. I grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, and there was a part of the Mass Turnpike in Newton that somebody bought the air rights and put a grocery store over. There was a grocery store and a hotel over the highway. And I remember there was all this discussion about who owns the air rights over that. So you're right. I mean, people will start litigating. Maybe I have this very humid patch of space. You can't grab my water out of it.
And investment opportunities for sure.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Well, actually, it made me think about one news that I've been kind of thinking to bring on, but I wanted to learn a little bit more about it. And it was about machine now that they're building to capture the carbon monoxide from, you know, the CO2 from the atmosphere that is the one that causes big part of the climate change and the warming of the planets. And, you know, normally that's something that the ocean will do. That's something that the trees will do. And we're just producing way too much for Mother Nature to take care of it itself. And so there are companies that are working on this kind of huge filter that would take it, pack it, put it maybe underground, kind of under the carpet, as we say sometimes. I hope we're not damaging something else by doing that. But I think that the thing that makes me think about that is that nothing really ultimately disappear. I mean, it's just same molecule that are just assembled in a way or in another, and they transform in one thing or another. And I think technology eventually it's going to help us to do the job that the nature and the planet is normally done by itself. So really, really cool. And I'm thinking even everyday application for that. You know, there are filters now when you're like in the wild or in the desert, well, in the desert, in places where, you know, you don't have access of like drinkable water, that you can filter the water from a river or even your own water, really, like astronauts do. And in this way, you can actually capture it directly from the air. It's pretty cool.
It is. And I thought it was really interesting that there is almost for about a million years, at least, I guess longer than that, there may be other things that impacted the amount of water on Earth. But if for about a million years, it's been almost the same amount. So we have more people on the planet now, but we have the same amount of water, and it does get, if we can recycle it and capture it in ways that it may not be available other ways.
And imagine that in places that they don't have access to drinkable water. And, you know, you go there and you help them, you drill, you do it well. And in this case, it seems like a lot much easier.
So I'm going to continue to be the negative nanny on this one.
Okay.
Just devil's advocate here.
Well, I'm just thinking that, so place I had in California near the coast, the plant life in this region, Santa Monica Mountains, thrives on the moisture in the air. And that's the only reason those plants mm-hmm. can survive. And a lot of them are drought tolerant. They don't get much from the ground, so they rely on the moisture in the air. And I'm just thinking the cause and effect of this. So if we're taking the moisture out of the air that's destined to go to plants or birds or whatever that would otherwise rely on, are we perhaps causing another effect that we're not aware of? And we talked about this in previous episodes in different scenarios where we're doing something that we don't know the impact of it on a bigger scale.
That's true. That there is always that when you can create an imbalance in the force, right? But when you throw off a natural system, and
but
it may not be a problem. But if we're not researching that along with, and this kind of goes
in, right.
I think it's a good point because you always need to think, and that's what we do. I always want to change the name of this program into What If, because we're always like, hey, here's an idea. Okay, but what if? Oh, damn it. Here's the party pooper. But it actually made us, it makes us think over. And I'm just connecting to the fact that Diana said, the amount of water is always going to be the same. So you're collecting it. You're maybe utilizing it to irrigate certain part of the planet or give water to drink to certain part of the planet. I can't see how deploying, removing all the moisture from, especially in the area where you have an abundance of it, that's exactly where you don't need it. I'm guessing, I don't know. I mean, but there are definitely places where if you don't abuse the technology, it would be extremely helpful. I think.
Yeah. And maybe it's something where if there isn't there's like a humidity index, if it isn't at a certain amount in that area, then the, you don't have it actually working, right? The AWG won't work, but for areas where it's really, really humid, because there are some places where it's very humid, but also for a variety of reasons, there's not a lot of access to clean water. So there may be water around, but it's not clean. It's not potable. Mm-hmm. So in those cases, maybe then it would be useful. And you could probably make an AWG that, speaking of building security in, that if there's not a certain humidity index, it won't operate. It says there's not, we need to leave this in the air for the plants, the plants Sean was talking about that need it.
That's right. That's right. So to go positive, I can, Marco mentioned kind of the personal AWG, the POG, out in the wilderness. Some of my favorite times are when I'm in the woods, disconnected from everything, and you have to source your own water. So hikes are planned around where water sources can be reached, and filters are carried and purifiers, and to make it safe to drink, those are carried with you. And I don't know exactly how it works. I don't know how fast it works, but I can see, okay, if I can get the water from the moisture in the air and not have to find the path along a stream or next to a lake, that could open up many more routes.
Oh, yeah, that was one of the things that came to my mind immediately. Yeah. Again, you go in places where they don't have water in the desert and you're given an easy access to that. So I don't think you need to deploy an entire area to get a couple of gallon of water to make people drink and have access to potable water.
I wonder how much water there is in the desert, though. Just thinking about having grown up in New England near the water, and we had really sticky, humid. It felt like you could just reach out and grab the air and wring it out. As opposed to being in Las Vegas, where it's so arid. I'm wondering, you think that it's possible to pull water? Is there still water in the air when it feels that dry? That I don't.
Yeah. Okay. On night, the desert is pretty, it's known to be much colder. That's where the plants and the animal get their, what they need. from there. And I mean, then there are desert, like, I don't know, like Joshua Tree, it snow there. You know what I mean? Sometimes it does.
Right. Yes.
I don't know the Sahara Desert, but I think at night there is a certain level of moisture that is enough to, I mean, unless you're in Death Valley, I guess that's why they call it Death Valley for a reason. Like, there is no life, but okay. Even there, I think the nature find a way to go by. They always do.
Everything needs water at some point.
Yeah, yeah. And so, Sean, you get micro nano. What the hell?
I'm curious. I can certainly connect this loosely to Diana's tech news. And my news is around micro and nano satellites. It's not new technology necessarily, but the news that crossed my path is that university in Philippines built two nano satellites that are being launched. They were launched. They're building two more for other purposes later. They only weigh just over a kilogram each, these cube nano satellites. And I mean, these ones are specifically equipped. I'll go back. They've delivered to Maya 1, Maya 2, and now they've done two more, Maya 3, Maya 4. And these cubes have antennas, solar array panels, a GPS chip, and a lever switch, which is used to change things. And most importantly, they have five commercial off-the-shelf 5 megapixel cameras that are commercial cameras, not specially built, attached to the cubes. And their sole purpose is to, in low orbit, capture photos and videos of the greater Philippines area. And they're looking at bodies of water. They're looking at land. Let me go here to find all the list of stuff. So they're looking at landmass, bodies of water, and also remote areas that you can't get into. So maybe this is where it's loosely connected. Maybe there are areas in the Philippines that you can't get to that have resources, water or otherwise, that could be used. So they're capturing this data and using it to, I presume, help understand the geography and the resources to better plan specifically around the Philippines area. And so they've launched these two new ones, and they're building two more, Maya 5 and Maya 6, that are larger. Now, this is cool because it's a university, right? So it's not some big, huge commercial entity building these things. These are researchers, students building these satellites. And they're going to be tasked with looking at the bigger picture. And this is what really struck me. Given the events of the last few weeks and the water on the East Coast and coming up through the Mexican Gulf, Gulf of Mexico, they're going to be looking at monitoring for natural disasters, managing forests, managing crops, how land is being used, and looking at changes in land mapping. So a bigger picture of what's going on with the land. So I can see it being used for understanding where resources are being overused or abused or underutilized, and yet they can't get to them through normal means. But if there are resources there, perhaps they can find a way if they know that there's enough there to make it worth their while to do that. So that's my story. I mean, two parts, really cool technology, nothing unique about photos and videos, but what they're looking for and what they're trying to do with it is cool. And it's all coming from a university in the Philippines, not some big commercial US company or European company that we might otherwise think about.
And is it deployed now, or are they just deploying it?
One and two have been deployed, three and four have been deployed. They evidently, they go on the Dragon up to the International Space Station, and then from there they do their deed, they do their thing.
Yeah, wow. I think there was other university. I remember I read somewhere about something, this little mini satellite that they were developed by other university. Mm-hmm. And you can, the other thing cool is that you can launch a ton of them. I mean, you literally, you can put it on a small rocket and deploy many of those. And I'm wondering if, I don't know if this article was saying something about that. You talk about video and monitoring that, but could they also be used to kind of amplify like the Wi-Fi signals to for communication purposes? So to give internet to areas that are not possibly being covered by.
I suspect some could be equipped with that. These are not built for that.
Yeah, but I'm thinking that technology, I mean, if you can put something to capture images, it could probably bounce a sound or any kind of wave, electromagnetic wave signal, I guess.
And do they have any constraints on what they're actually monitoring and looking at? Because then there's always that privacy concern of them being too monitored from the sky.
Of course, as you might expect, not very much discussed in terms of rights of the content and the level of detail and when information is captured and who it's shared with. So not much in that sense. So,
of course,
certainly a number of questions.
we'll worry about that when that happens.
Exactly.
Talking about thinking ahead of the game. Yeah, I think the application are many. I'm just always have this idea of how much trash there is already in the lower atmosphere. And, you know, usually, I mean, by trash, I mean satellites that are broken or, you know, that they're just floating up there. And some people were saying that eventually you have to consider that. I mean, many space debris, they get pretty close to the International Space Station and they can damage other satellite. So a note on that is that there are, I don't know, let's just call them waste management space companies that are actually going to put up some kind of a, you know, like a big waste management truck that is going to collect eventually, start collecting the trash that we put out there. So there is a business for that. There is a business for that.
Yeah. No, seriously, I'm not kidding. You're right. There is going to have to be some sort of debris. We have to, just like people are now have businesses that go into the ocean and clear out the giant plastic balls. And there's the, what is that called in the London sewers? The fat Bergs or whatever, right? There's companies that get the fat bergs out of the sewer. I bet that there's going to be companies that need to get space debris too.
Mm-hmm. And then what are we going to do? We're just going to pack. Let's say you have started having these hotels like space tourism that we talk about a lot. And then when all the trash that we do there, do we bring it back to planet Earth? Or we're just going to do another rocket that is going to, I don't know, put it on the dark side of the moon and kind of forget it there. I'd be curious to see how we're planning all that. If we're just going to be human all through, or if you're really going to think about what we're going to do before we actually do it.
We need like the Wall-E trash compactor too.
Yeah.
Smaller. Just open the chute and out it goes. It doesn't matter where it ends up.
Yeah.
It's in space. Who cares?
You know, you always, it's so easy to make the reference to what the ocean used to be in terms of exploration and make the equivalent into what space is, right? Oh, it's in the ocean. We dump it in the ocean. It's huge, you know, and now we do the same thing in space, except that, you know, they don't go away. They keep rotating in around the planet. And can you imagine if a bag of trash is going to get to an alien civilization and it says, damn it, the stupid Earthlings got here too.
And then they get angry at us. But yeah, it's true. We do have such a different view. I remember people saying, oh, just I'm going to throw it in the ocean. Or in like the 60s and 70s, cigarette butts. And everybody threw those all over the place. And now it would be, you know, you see somebody do that in a car. We see somebody smoking and it's weird. But see somebody do it in a car now and it's like, I get horrified. But that happened all the time in the 70s.
Well, it's not just the cigarette butts. I mean, not too long ago, they were finding out, and I can even imagine in other places, but here in LA, Sean, I don't know if you read it, but between pretty much Long Beach and Catalina Island and a little bit north, like Oxnard and that area, chemical company, they were dumping literally, containers full of very radioactive and chemical like pollutant. And I remember reading this article where sometimes these barrels, they wouldn't go down in the water. So they will shoot them, right, with rifles and guns. So they will make holes in it so that the air will go in and then the air will go out and they will sink at the bottom of the ocean. By doing that, they would also release all the chemicals that were in there. I mean, this is how human been thinking. And that's what scares me the most about going and polluting somewhere else.
So one point on that. Yes, if I've read that. And I get an email alert at least once a day from LA County with news about the poor quality of water up and down the coast.
Yeah, no shit.
And so I'm numb to it now. I'm over, not overwhelmed, but fatigued with that news. So I don't even know the extent of the situation, because at some point it was, this really sucks. I don't need to hear about it again because I'm not going in the water anyway. And that's probably not the right attitude, but it's the,
well, you eat fish eventually if you're not vegetarian, and that's why we have plastic in our body. That's why we have all sort of stuff in our body. You know, that's just the way it goes. Nothing. I go back to Diana. Nothing disappear. It's just shape shift. And so, I wonder why do I have plastic in my body? Well, because we throw it in the ocean and the fish eat it and we eat the fish. And or they go in the soil and plants end up having plastic in their thing. And, you know, I think this is the time that we are patching all the bad things that we've done in the past. Or at least we're trying. And some people are just like, whatever, let's let the next generation take care of that, which is the most selfish and attitude that pissed me off the most when we talk about this kind of things.
And it may be that we are just more aware of it, because I don't think, because, you know, when you were talking about the water and the ocean, Marco, I was thinking about Aaron Brockovich or the book, A Civil Action, which are both about, you know, chemicals getting into groundwater and then causing illness and cancer and clusters and in areas where people, you know, in the communities where, I think that while both of those, they helped to raise awareness, and I don't think that the companies that did the dumping were totally, you know, I'm not going to go defending them because I think they knew that they were doing something wrong, but I don't think that it was, I don't know if it was understood so clearly that you dump it into the water, to your point, Margo, it's not going to just disappear, that it's actually going to cycle back to us one way or another and potentially cause illness or, you know, some other damage to the system, right? Whether it's to us personally or it's to the health of the birds and the bees and the plants around us, but that it'll throw the system off somehow in a negative way. I'm not sure the interconnectedness was as understood a few decades ago. I hope it's more understood now.
I think they knew, most of them. I'm not going to give an ignorance as an excuse. Yeah. There are plenty of cases where we knew that lead was poisonous. We knew from back in the Romans where they put lead in the, you know, in the plumbing, and people would go crazy and get sick and die. And just now, we are finally without lead in gas. We knew it was bad.
That's right.
We knew cigarettes were bad. I don't care. You show a freaking doctor smoking Camel. You know, let's go marketing. And there's plenty of those examples that it clearly show that they knew. And that, sure, someone may have not known. Some are not calculable. But I think we need to just be forward thinking, and that's the thing.
I wonder if there are VCs looking at this, because Margo, you said some people may be trying to help patch and fix and clean up, and I'm just wondering, are there people dedicated to doing that? Are there companies dedicated to doing that? I mean, or is everybody like me and just apathetic and just let it go because it hasn't directly impacted me?
I think there is a big business in that. You know, there is a business in doing damage, and there is a business in resolving and patching the damage. I believe right now you want to put the money into companies that are, you know, in touch with the environment, because it has to be the future. I'm sorry, it's the only future that we really have. Yeah. We can't ignore it anymore.
Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe I'll look next time to see if they're big news items for that technology to help with that. Because, I mean, we see a lot of talk, brands taking a stance on their own operations and their own way of doing business to not further create damage or harm. But I see less of the other, where it's companies coming in to kind of fix and save the day kind of thing.
Yeah, look into that. There's definitely something about that. And I'm actually going to talk about that.
All right.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly that, but it's kind of funny because when I saw Aqua Diana, I'm like, uh-oh, she's going to go with Hydro here. Because my news today, instead of going historical, I want to go in something that I really love, and is the hydroponic farms. The one that, you know, that nowadays, thanks to technology, thanks to artificial intelligence and the lights and all the things that we need to make it happen, we can turn parking lots, we can turn cattle farms into greenhouse pretty much for cultivating plants that have a lot of advantages. One of that is that they don't need much of what, ideally, they don't need any poison to protect from bugs and stuff like that. They're very organic, and because you know, you can do a sterilized environment. You can do so many more crops than you could ever do multiple times a year. You're not dependent on the environment, the dryness, too much water, too much cold, too much anything. I mean, it's a controlled environment. And they also use 70% less water than what you would use in a normal farming farm. And the other cool thing, and this is where I got really excited about it, because I thought it was a really cool story. You can repurpose a lot of these places that you're not even thinking about repurposing. Like I say, parking lots, skyscrapers, old storage houses. But in London, they've actually used the bunkers where they used to go and hide during the Second World War, where they were bombed by the Germans. And these farms are literally underground the city. So when you're ready to bring the harvest to the restaurants or to the store, you can do that at a very, very short distance. So you have almost like a mile zero kind of economy. So I just can't think of anything that is bad about this. I think it's amazing because, you know, it's about repurposing things, using artificial intelligence and machine learning to really learn about the right amount of light, the right amount of response that each single crop would need. And I think it's great. I think it's a great opportunity for helping Mother Nature for once.
And so, they're full of food when they need to be bunkers again.
I hope not.
We have to go underground.
I hope not, but it also makes me think of, you know, you're actually learning how you can do this kind of stuff in an environment where you don't have the light, the sunlight, you don't have the atmosphere. So if you're thinking about you're going to grow your food in a space station, which they're already doing at the International Space Station, when you live on the moon, when you live on Mars, if we're ever going to get there, this is the way you are going to do that. So
I don't know if it's covered in the article, and I'll make this comment and her question, and Diana can jump in. But one thing that comes to mind when I think of farming and crops is the moment of harvest. And we're bound to climate outside, right? And so I don't know what time of year it is. Strawberries all come at once. They all get picked. There's strawberry season. You eat the strawberries. A lot of them go to waste, the ones you don't eat. Or maybe they get canned or something else. But my point is there's a cycle. I'm wondering, does this kind of flatten that where you can actually, because you mentioned artificial intelligence.
Well, you have multiple harvests. Yeah. You're not dependent on that. So many of these, they actually get, there is an advantage in the way that they deliver nutrient to your body, because most of them are given to the restaurant when they're still young. Like, they don't make it grow so much, you know, like, oh, the biggest watermelon and that tastes like nothing, or, you know, like you sell it by the pound. This is their soul when the crop is still young, when it's rich of nutrients, and because they can produce it much, much more. You know, when the cycle is over, you're just artificially recreating the environment to do it again. So there is more production, to answer your question, that doesn't need to come from, you know, like I talked to my mom many times. It's like, you know, we remember when it's like, oh, it's like you said, strawberry season, it's orange season. And now you go to a supermarket and you always find everything you want, because maybe it come from Thailand, it come from Mexico, or it come from any other place in the world. But think about the pollution and the carbon footprint that you do by doing that. And then eventually you ended up throwing it away. Mm-hmm. So this idea of you pretty much order it, you get it. I mean, a lot of investors in this, I'm talking about London, but this is happening everywhere. Las Vegas is happening in Kentucky, where apparently there is the biggest hydroponic farm that there is, and it is going to be doing this in Dubai and many other places, is the fact that you pretty much, in London, the investors in this were the restaurants itself. Like they know it's actually a better product. And so you're like, yep, just deliver upstairs and we'll put it on the table. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and greenhouses have been around for a long time. And it is nice, like the farm we belong to, they grow lettuce in the middle of winter because there's enough sun. There's a lot of sun actually in the winter. And, you know, as long as you can protect the plants, you can grow them, quote, out of season. But the question I have about the hydroponic is related to pests and insects, because I wonder, what is the pest situation? Is it pest free because it's growing inside? Mm-hmm. Do you need some pests to aerate this? I mean, how does that work? And I get kind of creeped out thinking about if we're going to spray pesticides in this hydroponic farm that's all fairly enclosed.
If it's done the right way, it's like going into a surgery room where, you know, I mean, they give tour of these bunkers, World War II bunkers in London, but other places. Yeah. They say that when you go there, it's like, you know, when you see that you're entering in a surgery room, where you're entering from outer space into, you know, I always think space, but, you know, where there is that hyperbaric chamber where you leave what is outside and you clean up and you sterilize and you go in there. So the point is not that there is not pesticides, because they are a controlled environment.
And no hornworms on your tomatoes.
Nope. Apparently not.
Okay.
It's a win-win.
So what about this, though? Do we think that the bugs do anything good for the plants? Because you were talking, Marco, about like the nutrients, and there's two issues with the nutrients, right? One is that we're raising plants in a way that doesn't allow them to come to the maximal nutrient level sometimes. But the other one is soil, because dirt is so important to creating that environment for the plants, and they actually get some of their nourishment from the soil. So without the soil and without the bugs that are in aerating and doing other stuff in the soil, putting, I think, vitamin B12 into it, could that be a problem? Do we know that these plants are as nutritional as they could, organically raised counterpart?
They are, also because there's no soil. That's the thing. They're hydro. So it's water. Yeah. And the nutriment is placed in the water. And the nutriment is made of fish components, or other time components that come from nutritional. I mean, they recreate the nutritional environment that is needed for this plant to grow. So there is no soil.
Water
from the Thames.
But now I'm worried about if it's really coming from different nutrient sources that we may not know about, like fish, for example. Are they going to have to put notifications for people that have severe allergies? Like, I have a severe allergy to shellfish. You said fish, not shellfish. But, back in the day before I was a vegan, I actually reacted to eggs, not because I'm allergic to eggs, but because the chickens that laid the eggs were fed soy layer pellets, and I'm very allergic to soy. So I'm wondering if they might need to mark what they put into the nutrients of the water in order to feed those.
I'm sure they'll have to. I mean, there is different kind of nutriment you can give to the plants so that they don't need to grow on fish scales or anything. I was reading that that actually the cultivation is it can be done in different ways. My other thing is, at least you have control of this, because when you are in an environment that is, you know, a field and everything, I mean, to be honest, do you know what they give to the plant?
Yes.
Well, that is a good point, right? Because that's one of the reasons that's why we belong to a farm, and we try to buy organic produce as much as possible, because we're trying to get at least a little bit of a better handle. Because you're right, you don't know nowadays what's put on the plant, and it could be something that maybe you don't want to eat. Although I don't think they spray fish. Maybe they do.
They probably do. If they're fertilizing, it's probably a mix of different proteins.
Yeah.
Some you may not want, and others you really probably don't want.
And mostly poop.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, a lot of poop.
But it's necessary.
Definitely a lot of poop.
Mostly is manure. I remember growing up with, you know, my grandfather comes from the, you know, from a farming family. And what are you going to give to the plants? You give the leftover of the other animal that were in the, you know, it's a cycle. I think we are going to finish this conversation what you started.
Yeah.
It's a cycle. And
I want to make one comment before
we
wrap, though, because I think there's at least one important point here. And I hearken back to the W Hotel in San Francisco that has a bee farm on the roof.
Uh-huh.
And they... One, it's to support the plant life in the city and to keep bees alive. But they also harvest the honey and use it in their baking on premises in the restaurant.
Ooh.
And Mark, you mentioned the restaurant can call down and say, give me 10 heads of broccoli.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of that is there are no trucks driving around.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. There is a mile zero concept.
Yeah.
And
that's true.
And you harvest in real time, so just in time harvesting, right there and local. I think it's pretty dang cool.
And the pollution that there is in the environment too. I mean, the, just think about bugs. I mean, think about cars driving by and other kind of stuff that you have in the air.
So Sean, that apiary is on the W, the one by the Moscone?
Exactly.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very proud of it. I've had, the main claim to fame is the drinks made with honey. They're honey-touched drinks, but they also use it in some of the meals.
Yeah. I mean, think about that. You know, like when you, this may be a conversation for another time, but, you know, they're repurposing a lot of building in the city. There are some that you see in picture. They're all covered in plants there because it retained the temperature. It, you know, they save in either AC or heater cost. But also, mm-hmm. of course, you use it to repopulate the city with greens. And think about if every block there is an hydroponic farm where you can go and, you know, and get your food right there. And you give jobs to people. You bring back things right into the city instead of having to drive in truck back and forth. I mean, I think the advantage is it's incredible.
You can keep an eye on the crops with the micro satellites.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Or you just have probably sensors inside the buildings.
Yeah.
And watered with AWGs.
So I guess ultimately maybe we are doing something good. And I think that to go back to what you said, Sean, I think that anybody that does investment nowadays in the future has to keep in mind the environment. It has to keep in mind, you know, the health of humanity and also how to conserve all of it. I mean, just the fact that you use 70% less water. It's kind of funny because you actually grow them in the water, but you use less water because there is no dispersion of water. There is not the sun that is drying it up. There is a cycle that you can control. Is it natural? No, but we can't live with nature, so we may as well do our own. Let's do it right.
As long as we think about the system and keeping it safe. Yeah, I agree.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mother Nature may play less fairly over time with us.
Mm. Well, good chance that there is that. But let's definitely talk about, I would say that, let's talk about a company that are making investment in anything that is, you know, energy conservation, energy production, hydroponic agriculture, and so many other things that are going to make our life a little bit easier, or at least maybe as it used to be when there was less population and we didn't have to give food to everyone like we're doing now. That's another problem, right? I mean, we're creating, there is a lot of waste. Like we say we don't produce enough food for the entire population, and then we throw away probably one third of what we produce because we cannot deliver it where it's needed, and because some places they wanted the abundance and they don't use it. So there gotta be a balance that we need to control. The hope is that.
We'll uncover those as we can here on Through the Tech Vine every week, same time.
We hope you enjoy
three of us and our guest
and our invisible friend's guest. He non-binary did really good today.
They
All right, peace out everybody, hitting the end of the broadcast. See you next time.
Ciao,
ciao. Ciao, ciao.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Through the Tech Vine podcast. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.